March Madness is here, and if you want to enhance the experience, join me, Gary Parrish, and my colleague Matt Norlander on the Ion College Basketball Podcast, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. We have new episodes at least three times a week and at the end of every night of the NCAA tournament. So before you go to bed, hang with us or know we'll be there when you awake. We'll break down games, make picks against the spread. Most of all, we'll have a blast. So join us on the Ion College Basketball Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ron, wow, what a late night joy that was. Congratulations on the first game of the year in America. In America.
Yes, in America. It was a nice ball game for the Cubs, absolutely. Fun night. Opening night is always, opening day is always a fun day. You could feel it around the clubhouse. The thing that was enjoyable, too, that, you know, we don't talk about enough is when young guys make the team for the first time, like Gage Workman, Matt Shaw, some of that stuff to me is really cool too. You know, you revert back to being a kid, you know, growing up and trying, you know, I can remember playing Little League baseball right in Chicago, you know, and wishing that would happen one day and hoping. And so for a couple of those guys yesterday, that came true. So a pretty cool day all in all.
Miguel Amaya wasn't making his debut, but he certainly wouldn't qualify as a guy maybe is proven, has a lot to prove this year, and he started out the right way in the reopening day against the Diamondbacks. Coombe, 5 runs batted in. Amaya, 2 for 5, batting ninth, which I think the reconfiguration of the batting order helped a lot of Cub fans feel better about what they were looking at. But Amaya especially, how big of a season is this for him, and is he the guy that you're seeing continue the momentum he established at the end of last season?
I would say yes, David. He has a chance to really have a great year. He does. And I think he's got a lot to owe to, you know, the period of time that we went back in the middle of last season when they gave him the weekend off and counts and hitting coaches, you know, took 3 days in the cage and just revamped his setup. And all of a sudden now, you know, he's in a position to make a good pass at the ball. He's had a very good spring. He uses the whole field, and he's a really strong guy. So I like his chances offensively to do some damage. The other thing, too, is he uses the other side of the field. Spring training, he did a lot of damage to right center field. Not home runs, but, you know, extra base hits and driving the ball in that gap. So he's really on track. He's had a good last 6 weeks.
It is. It's fun to see 10 runs. I don't care who you are. Everybody likes it when you score a lot of runs. But I thought that I was surprised, frankly, that Zach Gallen wasn't better than he, you know, he's usually very good, and you kind of caught him on the right day. And I thought that Justin Steele was better than he was in Japan, and he was better than Gallen, if that's possible.
It is possible. Here's the one thing, Mike, I really believe this too. I don't care how long you've been in the league or your status in the league, sometimes opening day is a different gig. And being the guy that's pitching on opening day is a special thing. And I really felt like Gallen yesterday, the adrenaline rush of pitching, he could never find his fastball. He was pulling it down and away from the righties or into the lefties. Then he would make the adjustment and he would sail one, you know, head high or higher. He just couldn't find a release point. And then the Cubs did almost all their damage, knowing that the pitch he could throw for a strike was his breaking ball, kind of that medium slider curveball, not the real biting breaking ball that he was throwing. So he had trouble yesterday, and I think Justin got through some of that early stuff. And then about the fourth inning, it seemed like Justin Steele all of a sudden found that fastball, that four-seamer that he buzzes inside to the righties, and his velocity went up 2 or 3 miles an hour. In the fourth inning, it just was like, and there it is. And he found that pitch, and he started dominating.
What are your impressions of Kyle Tucker, who did have a hit last night, drove in a run? He also walked, pretty selective at the plate, taking a lot of pitches, as is his method, and you respect that because it makes obviously it's why he is the hitter that he has become. Early on, though, Coom, being around him and seeing him now come back, what are your early impressions?
That he knows what he's doing on a baseball field really well. I mean, he's just a really talented guy, and has just missed clicking on probably six or seven balls between this spring and yesterday. The ball he hit to left, I thought had a chance of going out of the park. They caught it right at the wall. So I think he's going to have a big year for the Cubs. I really do. He's one of those players that does so many things well that he's going to influence the game in a lot of ways.
You know, were you surprised by the decisions that were made for the final roster, including Poteet getting cast asunder? That was the only guy they got in the Bellinger trade, but we all know that was as much a dumping of a salary as anything right. else.
I thought the Cubs did what I figured they would do. I didn't know about that move.
Right.
The final bullpen moves, you know, to me, every year are one of those things where you can make a case for probably three guys or four guys, depending on your camp that you're in. So it's a very difficult one on that last roster spot or two. I can speak just from my own experience, Mike. I can speak of what the roster looks like position player wise. The bullpen, that's one of those things, man. You can make a case for a lot of different things. But when Bruján went down, he banged into the wall and hurt his elbow. That made it real easy for me. I thought all of a sudden now you get to put him on the injured list, not lose him because he's out of options, and keep Gage Workman, who brings something to the table that's very unique. He's a young player that you go, wow, this guy might make our roster, but might be playing in another couple months somewhere. I don't know if it's third base, but somewhere, because he's really playing well.
We're talking with the great Ron Coomer, who is also the brand ambassador on Cubs Radio for Yuengling Beer, the new official beer of the Cubs Radio Network here on The Score. Coom, you mentioned Gage Workman. He's going to get a start at some point. He's played left field. He's played second base. He's a natural third baseman. Do you think we see him tonight, tomorrow? Is it important to get him in early because he was left alone, basically, and all but forgotten in Japan?
Yeah, I would say it's important to get him in there, but I don't necessarily know if he's going to start right away. You know, you got another guy, Matt Shaw, who you're trying to get comfortable at third. The one spot that he could start, and it's really kind of what Craig Counsell wants to do. Do you want to get Birdie in there, who had a good game, you know, against the Dodgers in Japan, or do you want Workman in there? I think maybe the matchup might determine that. But, you know, he could play second base. I was amazed at how well he moves in the middle infield when the Cubs gave him a chance to play short and second. So I'm just happy for him, David. You've got one game under your belt that's a win. He'll get in there probably within the next 4 or 5 days. Nico Horner, from watching him yesterday, I think he's going to need some days off here in this first month to really protect that elbow so he doesn't flare it up. Looked like to me yesterday he kind of goosed that last throw to first base to end the game. And that tells me that playing 9 innings and all the throws and all that in between innings, you know, he's going to need a little time still.
I kind of like the way that that they handled it with Hap at the leadoff spot. I know that, you know, maybe that changes as the year goes on, but he's good there. And God, he played well yesterday.
He really did. He had a very nice day yesterday. And, you know, he's one of those guys. He definitely checks the box of a guy that gets on base, right? His on-base percentage is always good. He works the pitcher. He's never that quick at bat. Because he's a little over aggressive. Very seldom do you see that from Ian. But very nice day yesterday, spraying the ball around the yard, and you know, he's done an excellent job in left. So that was a very nice thing. And you know, the other thing too, he just missed hitting a home run late in the game too. He hooked one just foul. So that was the Cubs need him to have a big year if they're going to be playing in October, that's for sure.
Kumi mentioned Gage Workman and Matt Shaw, guys enjoying their first opening days as a major league player. What do you remember about yours? Where did it come, and what stands out in your memory?
Oh, that's 2 years ago. We got to go back to the memory banks. I remember, you know, the call. I was playing in Tacoma, Washington, the night before. I get traded at the trade deadline, David, August 1st or the 31st of July, and in Tacoma, and I got pulled off the on-deck circle, and I get told by our trainer, and Rick Dempsey was my manager, the old catcher for the Dodgers, but really Baltimore is where he's known. And they just told me, they go, we hope you never play another minor league game again. You're going to the big leagues. You've just been traded to the Twins, and you're going to Cleveland to play the Cleveland Indians tomorrow. And I just remember walking in the clubhouse and seeing Puckett's jersey and Knobloch and some of the guys, Rick Aguilera, and you're looking around the clubhouse going, well, this is pretty cool, you know, and being able to call my family. You know, I got to hit the second day, my first big league hit, I got to hit the second day off Mark Clark. So it was a pretty cool experience. It's the adrenaline rush is absolutely incredible when you go to home plate, let me just tell you.
Any truth to the rumor, Coom, that first hit was a bouncer off Mark Clark's glove?
No, it was not. It was a ground ball in the hole for a base hit.
Just making sure. Just making sure.
Hole, yeah. It was not. I would have thrown that one back.
I heard that somewhere.
Yeah.
I have. I don't know where, but yeah. It was like, yeah, it's ringing a bell from a week ago, I think.
How relieved do you think the Cubs were just to get a victory after having to stew? Even Jed Hoyer alluded to it before the game, Coom. He was talking about, you know, it's not so much starting 0-2, because if you do start 0-2, you can win on Sunday in many series, and you can erase some of that bad feeling. But the Cubs had to sit around and hear about how the 0-2 start was a bad way to begin a season for 8 days.
Yeah, I think it was a nice win. It really is. You know, if you've been around our game a long time and you can, you know, put some of the things that are said where they belong, you know, you played two games. You still got, you know, a whole boatload of games to go. So, you know, you can – the first game always feels like a bigger win or a bigger loss than it really is. But you don't want to go 0-3, and this club – and the schedule that the Cubs have in the first 25 days is pretty daunting. So, you know, when you get a win and you beat a guy like Gallen, that's a big win, because Cubs are really going to have the work cut out for them in this month of April.
No doubt about that. J-Mo on the bump today. Tomorrow is Shota. It's you just want to win a series. I know that's asking a lot, but that's kind of what you need to have happen.
Yeah, I mean, you'd love to have that. If you split this series, so be it. But, you know, the whole goal, Mike, all season long, you win series. Yep. If you win series, you play playoff baseball. If you win enough series, that's what you do. So, you know, the short-term goal week after week is to win the series. And if you can do that, like I said, you're in great shape. Cubs are in great shape right now after a good effort from Justin and the offense really picked them up. They got a chance to win a series.
Coom, didn't he follow all the pregame stuff as closely because of everything else going on? I don't know if you noticed, but the Sox won and the Bulls won yesterday too. So it was a crazy day in Chicago. But Cubs related, is Matthew Boyd definitely starting Sunday? And he's in that fourth spot in the rotation?
I believe so, yes. Boyd has definitely been – he is in the fourth spot in the rotation, yes, and I believe he will pitch Sunday, correct.
Yeah, I think they had left it at TBD, but that's good news because if he's the pitcher that he was the second half of last season, they really could be onto something, and I think he showed some flashes of that during the exhibition game in Tokyo.
I would agree. He's a guy that we watched him pitch last year once he was healthy against the Cubs. And he really knows what he's doing with the baseball. He can pitch to both sides of the plate. He can run that. He's got that ability, David, to throw that fastball you know, and it's not a blazing fastball at 100 miles an hour, but that high riding fastball that starts out at the top of the zone and just doesn't come down into the zone and stays up high. And he gets that swing, and it may not be a swing and miss pitch, but from a right-handed hitter's perspective, it's that ball that you think you should be on, and you just hit that routine lazy fly ball like the right center, and you're like, I don't know, what happened there? And you watch, and he does it over and over and over. So he's going to be a guy that if he's healthy, which I think he is, could have a very good year. That's a great thought by you, and seeing what I think a lot of people are hoping happens.
I'm just curious. It is so weird to me that there are – so you guys are going to head to Sacramento, next Sacramento. And it's so weird to me. There are two teams playing in minor league stadiums in Major League Baseball. It's just such an oddity. We've seen it happen with one. The idea that there are two teams that are doing that, it just makes you wonder. And I know that it's just temporary and everybody's moving on. It's still like just an oddity.
It really is. I get the Tampa thing. I was down there. I have a house down there that's, you know, 25 minutes from the ballpark and close to Tampa Bay, also in Clearwater. And, you know, the hurricane situation was devastating mm-hmm. with two of them in a row. So you can understand what happened in Tampa. The Oakland thing to me is the puzzling one. You couldn't come up with an agreement to keep them in their stadium until the new one is built. I just can't comprehend how politically the two sides, because or really three sides, with Major League Baseball, the A's, and the city of Oakland couldn't come to an agreement where you could stay in your ballpark. Maybe this is a better situation for them. Who knows? That park was really getting pretty dilapidated, but I don't know. It's really an odd situation, Mike. I know they're going to try to make the best of it, but, you know, really? That's pretty bizarre.
That will be one of four opening days the Cubs participate in with all the pomp and circumstance, Coombe. I know we'll talk about it a lot. From a player's perspective, does it matter at all? Or do you just enjoy every moment? Because those are kind of things you don't want to take for granted.
Yeah, we're going to get opening day. Guys will be ready for just a normal ball game where you just go out on the field and play, you know, instead of getting introduced. You got four opening days the Cubs will have this year before the first week of the season is over. So it's pretty bizarre. I've never seen anything like it. But, you know, it just means you get to listen to Pat Hughes a little longer, David. That's what it is.
Never gets old. Never gets old.
You guys are the best. There's no doubt about that. Ron, thanks a ton, buddy. Great catching up with you. Great start to the season. You know, I know it's I know it's 1-2 for the Cubs, but it feels like things have turned. The tides turn. Everything's going well. It's just a good
start. Starting over,
yeah,
essentially.
The reopening.
Coombe, did you see the 47-foot shot by Josh Giddey last night?
I did not. No,
you got to check it out.
Heard about it. I've heard about it. I did not get to see it. I was watching the sunrise here in Scottsdale, Arizona. So I'm still I'm still pre-coffee. So give me an hour, David. I'll catch you. I'll be up to stuff on everything.
Sounds good. We appreciate you getting up early for
us.
Yeah,
always.
No problem.
Thanks,
at all,
Ron.
Boys. Yep, absolutely. You guys have a great weekend.
We're back with more of the Spiegel and Holmes Show, live from Stadium Swim, inside Circa Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book, on Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Sometimes I get a good feeling.
In about 10 minutes, we are going to talk with Cubs president Jed Hoyer. We'll get his thoughts as his team opens up domestically. Obviously, starting the season 0-2 after the first two games in Japan. They will play the Diamondbacks tonight. You will be able to hear that game and all Cubs games here on The Score. Speaks, the roster has now been finalized for domestic opening day for the Cubs. What do you think?
I think that it's a pretty good team. I think that offensively they should be better than last year, and they were actually pretty good last year. I think that, as we suspected early on, the bottom of the roster is a hell of a lot better than it was last year, and that's going to matter. Because dudes will play. John Birdie as your veteran utility guy who could start all over the infield is a hell of a lot better than Miles Mastroboni or Nick Madrigal. I think Vidal Brujan is more toolsy than those guys. I think Gage Workman is a very interesting lefty power bat that they're keeping, as for right now, as a Rule 5 draft pick from the Tigers. It depends. If PCA and Miguel Amaya are the guys that they looked like in the last 6 to 8 weeks of the season, that is improvement that's built in. And I happen to think that Dansby Swanson is going to take a step forward. But those are kind of theoreticals. So really, Kyle Tucker swapped in for Cody Bellinger is an upgrade, is a serious offensive upgrade. And so that is the biggest principal upgrade, is that one right there. And then the rest are kind of some offensive theoreticals and some steps forward. And there's a lot of options for who you think is going to take those steps forward offensively. And I think there are several, some of whom I've given you. But Kyle Tucker is the principal presence that's been added in exchange for Cody Bellinger. And that in and of itself does make them better offensively.
I agree with you. I think that they are a better team than what we saw last year. It was interesting, like, going through John Greenberg's piece in The Athletic with Jed and him talking a little bit about, hey, you know, you got to outperform the numbers and the projections. It's a little scary for any Cubs fan to hear that, because I feel like they've been living in this space of, instead of the roster being constructed to win 90 games, is you have to kind of hope and pray that some of this stuff happens, that Dansby Swanson isn't injured this year, and that he does give you some offensive thump that you're looking for in your lineup.
Yeah, you know, Craig Counsell famously directed his comments towards exactly that, towards the end of last year. And Tyler Farrengold, who's running the board for us back at the shop, has Craig Counsell in the final week of the season talking about what the Cubs should be doing in the offseason.
Yeah, I mean, we got to get better, man. Like, the team we're chasing is 10 games ahead of us. You got to get better. And we should try to be building 90-win teams here. I mean, you know, like, that's like what you have to do to, you know, that's a playoff standard. I mean, that's what you got to get to be safely in the playoffs, right? And safely in the tournament. So, from that perspective, you know, we got a ways to go.
Okay, so then we sat down with him at Cubs convention. It wasn't memorable for him. It was for us. And we asked him about whether or not he feels like the roster for the Cubs is closer to that 90-win mark.
Last week of the year when you said we should be in the business of building 90-win teams. The we was doing a lot of work there. Because, like, I kind of sat here like, hey, do you feel like Jed and Carter built you a 90-win team? That's not really a fair question because you're part of it. Do you feel like you guys have built a 90-win team, or do you feel like by opening day you will have built a 90-win team?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've got work to do still, and we're going to try to get there, absolutely. I mean, that's – and 90-win is a – I'm using that as a number. That's the playoff number. You know, it's not the it doesn't necessarily, but it's a playoff number, right? It's the playoffs, and that's what it takes to. And I think it takes a team like that to really compete at the World Series level. And so that's what I absolutely think the standard should be. It should be the expectation, and we should run from that.
So between that interview, Lawrence, and right now where we are, they added Gage Workman. And they added, I think, Carson Kelly. I believe that signing came after the convention, if I remember correctly. And not a whole lot. I guess Ryan Pressly. They added Ryan Pressly.
I think is a really strong move.
It is a very strong move. It is a very strong move, and that bullpen is deeper. I think Eli Morgan, who does make the opening day roster from Cleveland, was added after that conversation. So there are a few different additions. What there wasn't was an Alex Bregman, which would have, I think, sealed the deal. I think they'd be projected by just about everybody as a 90-win team if Bregman was your starting third baseman and Matt Shaw was either in AAA or was taking the Vidal Brujan backup depth spot. But he's not.
So to you, does it feel like – how would you describe what their chances are just from looking at the roster to win the division?
I think they've got a really, really good chance to win the division. I bet them as an over. I bet they're 85.5 as an over. I did think about everything else in the division. But it's an unbalanced schedule. It's a more balanced schedule, not the old unbalanced schedule. Instead of 19 games against the Pirates, now they get 13. So that makes a big difference. Two fewer series against the dregs of your division.
A team that's not trying at all.
But I must admit that them being the favorite to win the division has a pretty big component of the Cardinals stink. The Pirates are really bad. The Reds haven't quite done enough, in my mind. And the Brewers did not really add much offense. Now, the Brewers and the Reds could be better. And some people are picking those teams to be better. But I still think the Cubs are better right now.
Yeah, and look, I do think that if you're trying to project out as someone who runs a team,
yeah,
the ideal situation is that you're building no matter what. That you're trying to build a winner no matter what. And I get that there are going to be some financial limitations compared to teams like the Yankees and the Dodgers and the Padres occasionally that are going to make it difficult for Jed to do that the way that maybe he would like. The Cubs don't really do deferred money.
Even though they did, Jason Hayward's still making $5 million this year.
Right. But and that's a bank account that they're not willing to open up just yet. And that's what they figured out from a business standpoint, and so whatever. The secondary way to then go about it is, well, how does our division look? And what can we do that will make us competitive enough that we can make this spicy when August and September come around? I think it was a big step for Jed Hoyer to pull the trigger on the Kyle Tucker move. And it could blow up in his face. It really could if Cam Smith is good for a long time. And then at the end of this, Kyle Tucker ends up walking.
Yeah, if he's a one and done, that'll blow up in his face. But I'll tell you, he addresses it in the Q&A with Greenberg that you mentioned in The Athletic, that a lot of organizations have an eye on this possible impending work stoppage after, you know, the next two seasons. And that is behind the thought process of a lot of moves for a lot of different organizations.
And I got to tell you that I hate that.
Yeah, I know. You should.
I hate that because I feel like, you know, and
sucks.
Theo's brought it up a long time ago, like the idea of every season being precious and your opportunity to win the next World Series.
Right.
I kind of wish that some of these guys would look at it as, all right, who knows what the environment is going to look like once we get things straightened out from a work stoppage standpoint. Let's go right bleeping now.
Sure, and that might be the case in the offseason. There's a chance that they do sign Kyle Tucker after the season, you know, and that he will have been impressed and they will have, you know, fallen for him and they decide to invest. And I've had people within the organization tell me that some of the Bregman money decisions were about making sure that they can do Tucker, who they think is a better long-term investment. And I agree with that. So, but are they just kicking the can down the road? Are they just selling me a bill of goods when they say that? That is certainly open to interpretation. Or do they have a desire to do that? We'll have to see. And can I tell you, can I ask you, Lawrence, like, I love Terry Francona. That's my favorite living manager. That is my number one favorite living manager. And there's various reasons. One of them is, I know the job he did after Cleveland fell apart at the beginning of the 2017 season, the same way the Cubs did. I know from people inside what he did to attack that Cleveland slump. And if people don't remember, they won, 23 in a row down the stretch of 2017 after having a World Series hangover and having a bad first half that year. Like, he is an active and attentive, strong manager with personalities. So I love what he's going to bring to Cincinnati. And there's other reasons I love Terry Francona, but I just don't see it with that team. They're a very popular pick. They're a super popular pick. I saw Tom Verducci picked him. There's a ton of baseball experts who are picking Cleveland, Cincinnati to win that division. And I just don't see enough on the field to merit that.
I don't see it either. And you know that that's been one of the places where I would like to see Luis Robert be traded to. I feel like that would help them. And it addresses a need that they have.
They need another outfield bat, without a doubt.
And he plays great defense when he's healthy. So, whatever. I agree with you on Tito, like, being one of the more important managers over the last 30 years in baseball.
And he's just my favorite. You know, like,
it's
fun. And that stuff in the comeback, You watch The Comeback on Netflix. I mean, about the Red Sox. There's a moment where David Ortiz has been struggling, and he's at the batting cage, and he's really scuffling, and Terry Francona's sitting there watching him, and Ortiz is getting angrier and angrier, thinking that Tito sees something. He's not saying it. So he turns around, he says to Tito, what do you see? I know I'm scuffling. You probably see something. Fine. What do you see? And Terry says, me? I'm just staring into space. Hey, big guy, I hit 210. I hit 210. You're David Ortiz. You figure it out. And Ortiz laughed his ass off, and, like, he said something unlocked right then. He's like, oh, yeah, I can figure it out, because Terry's humble, man. He knows he didn't know how to do it like these guys did. So, like, stories like that, there's tons of stories about him helping guys relax and be the best version of themselves.
I think the Cubs have a manager that's got some of that in him right now.
Yes,
I think that totally Craig Counsell agree. is a player's manager in the sense that he understands what they're going through.
You bet.
He can speak to a lot of this stuff.
Yeah,
that's going to happen to them day to day.
I can't wait to watch the job that Craig Counsell does this year. Cannot wait. I'm expecting a lot. I'm sure Jed Hoyer's expecting a lot.
I am too, and it's because now I am going to give grace for the idea of, let me get in there and see how all of this works. And I think that was kind of what Craig Counsell was doing last year, along with, you know, obviously managing the team. But let me get out in here and see how I work with Jed and Carter.
Let me see how their systems work. Let me see what ways they do certain things.
How they view stuff.
Yeah.
Like what the scouts think about players and how different that might be from what I think about the players.
What information they value as opposed to what I value. And if there's things that I can change around. And I'm sure that he came across things he wanted to change. And I hope he's had a chance to change those things and assert himself in a new way, and he'll need to. For this team to do what it has to do, they're going to have to outperform some expectations, Jed Hoyer, and do what they do.
And that's not fun. I mean, I am known for the viral, you know, bully these hoes when it comes to the National League Central, and that's how I feel about it, that the Cubs should be in a financial position to really take advantage of. And I keep being astounded by how bad things are for the Cardinals organizationally, because organizationally they have been really, really strong. So to see them, like, it's like, here you go, the evil empire, the beast is wounded.
It's an interesting moment in this division, and that's why the Cubs are the favorites. One of the reasons that the Cubs are the favorites, and we're pleased on the Spiegel and Holmes show right now to bring in Jed Hoyer, the president of baseball operations. He joins us on the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline. Jed, thanks for your time. How you doing, sir?
I'm good. How you guys doing?
We're good, man. We were just talking about Craig Counsell and what it's going to be like to watch him do his job in year number two. Are you looking forward to seeing him do his job now that he's comfortable with everything and either knows everybody or played a part in the acquisition of some of the new guys?
Yeah, I think comfortable is a great word for it. I think that, you know, last year, you know, it's just kind of drinking from the fire hose, trying to learn all these different personalities, trying to learn a new place. And, you know, I think, you know, different coaching staff, et cetera. I think that now, you know, just a comfort, to use your word, that he had in spring training all off season is very different. So yeah, I'm excited about it. I think it's hard to come into a new place like that, and especially come in and not have all your own people. So yeah, I think he's looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to it, and I'm excited about it.
Jed, what was the value of the Japan trip for the Cubs specifically? I get what it did for baseball, but for the Cubs specifically, what was the value, and what, if any, do you worry about, being that you're really only about a week removed from that trip?
Well, I guess that's the kind of thing we just can't worry about. You just don't know, right? You don't know how it's going to affect you, and there's no point in being concerned. We've done everything we can do to sort of rest guys, get everyone ready. But as far as the value, I think the value is immeasurable. I think that, you know, forcing the team to be together really for a week in a foreign country, I think that was an awesome cultural experience. I think it was incredible for them to just to feel the energy that was there. I mean, it felt like two World Series games, but also like the bonding, you know, those are all, you know, probably 20 meals are eaten with the team together that wouldn't be eaten together if we were in spring training. And so I think it's just a different different experience. I'm talking to guys from the Padres and Dodgers for last year. They really felt like it helped them with their bonding as a team, getting everyone together earlier. And I think we'll feel the same thing.
Hey, Jed, I like this team. I like the depth. I like the back of the bullpen. Both of those things much more than last year on opening day. But would you say that you've built a 90-win team at this point?
Unclear. I mean, I think there's projection systems that say yes. There's projection systems that say no. I mean, ultimately, I think the beauty of this game is, you know, we need to go out and every day as an organization, from front office to coaching staff to players, like, we need to try to exceed expectations and we need to optimize our performance. And that's really, to me, opening day is, it's the, you know, it's the first tee shot off the tee box. It's the, you know, it's the first game of the season, and it sort of signals that baseball is back. But ultimately for me, it's just, okay, this is the journey and we need to, as a group, we need to outperform. And that goes really for everybody in the league, right? I think if we outperform, I think that we have a chance to be that 90-win team you're talking about, to you know, feel like we're a really deep, solid team. I think, but every team in baseball, I think, is looking to outperform and to get the best out of their guys, and you know, that's what starts today.
To get back to the word comfort, have you ever had a roster going into a season where you were like, you know what, I might not say it publicly, but I know that we're going to be good, and then they were good. And I'm curious on how uncomfortable it is when you do have a roster. You're like, well, this guy might have to play over what we expect or what the projections are for this player.
Yeah, very rarely, to be candid. I mean, a couple times here, maybe in 16 and 17, just felt like we were a cut above the rest of the league, honestly. You know, I think going into that season, I mean, we definitely felt that going into 16. And I think we won 9 more games than anyone else in baseball. And you know, really in Boston, never, I would say. The Yankees were, at all times, were so daunting at that point that you could never go in feeling that way. So, yeah, maybe once or twice. But I think the nature of the game and these jobs is that, you know, things are going to happen. It's such a long season. And I try to tell myself that on opening day every year. Things are going to happen unexpectedly bad, and things are going to happen unexpectedly good. And I think that, like, our job is to just never stop trying to improve the team, never stop, you know, never feel comfortable. Because I don't think, to answer your question, like, I don't think you ever feel comfortable. I don't think you ever should. And, you know, we're going to spend, you know, the next 6 months just trying to get a little better every day and trying to look for ways to improve, you know, off the roster if we need to.
Hey, Jed, I think if you guys are anywhere near 500 on May 12th, it bodes really well. You know, like, that's after a series at the Mets, and then there's a theoretical break in the schedule. It is brutal. Will you look at that? If you're 20 and 22 after 42 games, how do you think you're going to feel?
Yeah, no, I mean, I never really thought about it, like, lines of demarcation, so to speak. But I do think, yeah, it's a bear of a schedule early. You know, trying to look at it, you know, glass half full, that I think it's a good challenge for us. We're getting a lot of West Coast trips out of the way early, a lot of tough teams out of the way early, and we're going to find out a lot about ourselves quickly. You know, we're definitely going to be stress tested early, but there is a danger. You know, I felt that way a little bit last April, not quite as hard a schedule, but I think we were 16-9 or something like that, and then we struggled when we actually got into a little bit easier part of our schedule. So ultimately, yes, it's very hard to string long winning streaks together when you're playing teams like we are early. If you're playing well, you win games. If you're not playing well, you lose. And I think the way baseball is set up now, there's really only a handful of teams that are, like, kind of rebuilding. And so I feel like, you know, almost every series is a test now. And I think that's really good for baseball in general.
Hey, how is the change in the schedule from unbalanced to more balanced, where you lose 2 series with each of your division opponents? How has that changed the way you guys do your internal projections?
Well, yeah, it's just you know, I do think that I think it's way better for baseball, way better. I think that, you know, when you're playing, you know, your division, you know, 18 times, it felt like too much, honestly. It just felt like we were constantly playing the same teams. And I think from a fan standpoint, this is immeasurably better. But yeah, there's just fewer series head to head to control your destiny. So I do think that makes it a little harder that way. You're going to have to, you have to play well against everybody, but I do think it's just better for the game. I mean, it's great to know that you're going to play every team every year. I think there's real value in that from an industry standpoint, and frankly, from a fairness standpoint too. I think that this makes a lot more sense.
Jed, how do you keep – I'm trying to think of the right way to phrase this. How do you keep from being jealous of what maybe the Dodgers and Mets have while looking at your own situation and say, no matter what it is they have, we have to figure out a way to compete? How do you not allow for what other teams are doing to steal some of the joy of trying to to build a winning baseball team?
I don't know. I guess, I mean, it's my life, right? I think that when I drive to the Lakes, you know, Sheridan to head down to work some days, like, do I stop and get jealous and unable to complete my day looking at some of the houses on the water? Like, no, I don't. You got to do the best you can with what you have. And I think that's a job, right? You can't get jealous of everyone else. You know, they have their own challenges and own problems. And I think, you know, just knowing, you know, we knew what our payroll was. We knew what we had to do. And I think, you know, we worked hard this offseason to build the best team possible within that. And I just don't think you can get distracted by what others have. I don't think you can get distracted by, you know, jealousy as to your word or whatever, or complaining about it. You just move forward and try to do the best you can. And I think that there's only a handful of those in baseball, and that's a good thing, I think.
Yeah, there's a commandment about that. I think thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's payroll, I'm pretty sure.
I think that's New Testament stuff, man.
Yeah.
As a reprinting of the King James.
Yeah. I mean, maybe.
The King Bill James Bible.
Well done. Yeah. Well done, sir. Jed, what is fair for Cub fans to do? Because we're going to get both, okay? What is it fair for Cub fans to do? To compare Cam Smith to Kyle Tucker, or to compare Cam Smith to Matt Shaw? Which one is more fair for Cub fans to do? Asking for a talk show host.
Oh, I don't know. I think, listen, that's the nature of sports, right? Like, I think that when you're sort of building up, you're making trades on the other side of that ledger. You know, you're trading veteran players for young players. You know, it's how you end up with PCA. And I think we're in a sort of a winning window now. And I think you kind of flip that around. And, you know, we got one of the best players in baseball. And, you know, we gave up a really good prospect that, I mean, I'm proud of our amateur staff for identifying him. I think they did a great job on him. And so I think that's sort of the nature of it, right? That you're gonna make deals on both sides of the ledger. And Cam Smith's a really good player, and so is Kyle Tucker. And I think that's how you have to view it.
Where is the growth for PCA? Because he's clearly got star potential. I thought that watching him and Justin Turner in Japan, like, embrace being there and growing their own personal fan base with people in Japan was awesome. As a player, where can he grow into that thing that everyone's hoping he can be?
Yeah, to me, it's emotional. I think that, you know, he's a very, he plays with his hair on fire. He's very emotional. I think, you know, as he just controls each pitch, each at bat more, he's going to be a great player. I think that he has all the ability in the world. And he loves the game. He loves to play. And I think that just that's the hard part of this game, right? Is every single day the pitching is really good, and you can't get down about a bad swing or a bad at bat. You got to go do the next one. And I think that's where, the relationship with, the veteran guys, especially Turner, I think is really important, because all the tools are there, all the abilities there. He's super fun to watch. And I think that's just, the more he can slow the game down and sort of take out, pitch to pitch, I think he's going to be a great player in this league.
Back to the nature of fandom, to your point. Like, I think the White Sox asked for Rafael Devers when they traded Chris Sale to Boston, and they got told no and ended up with Yoan Moncada. You know, it's like, this is just the nature of it is. And then White Sox fans never forget that. There's a million things, and rather than asking you if the Astros would have taken Matt Shaw or Kevin Alcantara, I'm not going to ask that. But is there a trade in your past that you nailed, where you asked for the right prospect, whether it's in Boston or here in Chicago, when you were given a short list and you said, I'll take that guy, and you made the right call? I wonder what comes to mind for you.
That's a good question. I mean, I think that, I think you guys are probably asking for, like, deals that were really sexy sometimes. But, one that springs to mind, I guess, was, trading Feldman for Arrieta and Strope. That, we were adamant about getting both those guys, and I think we identified both guys really well as buy lows. I think that's one that that really springs to mind in terms of, like, you know, seeing the value in getting both guys. I think that's probably the one that springs to mind. But I mean, that is the nature of these jobs, right? There's definitely deals I can think of that I won't share where we ended up having a really successful deal and we were actually targeting a different guy, you know? And that happens, you know, and there's other times I think you target the right guy and, you know, he gets hurt or whatever. So I do think that, I've always felt like, you know, the best teams, they have good processes and they're transactional and you're not going to hit on all of them, but if you have a good process and you evaluate well and you kind of stick to that, I think, you know, usually those things balance out over time.
Arrieta and Strope for Scott Feldman as a sign-in flip is one of the great trades in Chicago sports history, to be honest. And I remember talking to you and Theo at Del Frisco's when we did a thing in like 2017 or 16, I don't remember. But I remember asking Theo, hey, how about that guy Kevin Gausman on Baltimore? Do people want that guy too? And he shot me a look like, everybody wants that guy. Everybody. So, like, yeah. That's a good example.
Gausman's a great example of, we messed that one up, you know? Like, we targeted him for years, and he went, I'm trying to remember the exact order, but I want to say he went to Cincinnati first and then went to the Braves, and We had a chance that it wasn't successful there, and we had been trying to trade for this guy for years, and then we didn't go after him after that because we're like, oh gosh, I guess we might have been wrong on that evaluation. And then he signed the 1 year deal with the Giants and took off. So that was a really good lesson for me. Where like when you like a guy like that and you identify him, don't give up like just because he stumbled somewhere else. And these paths these players take are far from linear, and I think that's something I try to remember all the time too. Kevin Gausman was a highly regarded, you know, first round guy who struggled and on his fourth team hit it, right? And it's just that's the nature of these of players sometimes.
Jed, thanks so much for the time. Good luck this season, and we appreciate you jumping on with us.
Always enjoy Vegas, guys. Don't think I was going to leave that out, you know.
Well, one of us is enjoying Vegas, and the other one is not.
Can we get down on anything for you? An NFL future, for instance. You like Stephon Diggs to the Patriots, by the way? You good with that one?
Aaron Rodgers to the Vikings, maybe?
Is that happening? I haven't read that. But, hey, listen, I like what the Bears have done a lot this offseason. I feel like, I know that's one I would buy hard on. I feel like when you look at how many close games they lost last year, and you know the fact, you know, now they're with a better line, and I mean I know their schedule's hard, but it just feels like that's one where they could be really undervalued in a good play.
I love that, Jed. As always, we appreciate it. All have right. fun.
Thanks, Jed. Guys. I appreciate it. See ya. Bye.
You got it. It's Jed Hoyer.
Jed. Bears meatball. Let's get it.
Hardcore, man.
Let's get it.
The other comp I was going to make about, like, Cam Smith versus Matt Schaar or whatever is when Shea McClellan got drafted, and I always think about Chandler Jones and Whitney Mercilus were still on the board as pass rushers.
Man. and for the win, let's say there's a mini categories here.
Yes, sir.
What two numbers did Shea McClellan wear as a Bear?
99. Oh, 99.
And?
54.
No, close.
51.
Close.
55. 50.
Yes. Oh, he wore two Hall of Famers numbers. And let me tell you.
He was not that good.
As someone who was doing a show with one of those Hall of Famers.
Yeah. It did not go over well.
It did not go over well.
That is outstanding.
Man, I loved your show with Mike Singletary.
It was. It was good.
Yeah.
Yeah, they kept. But the only problem was the ratings kept getting lower.
Lower.
We'll take a break. We'll come back, react to that, talk some more absurdities.
White Sox winner.
Oh! And wait till you hear who was pitching at the end of that game for the Angels.
And wait until you hear who made his official plate appearance in that game late.
Ooh, I'm interested.
And got some boos.
Uh-oh.
Snacks on the score.
It's been a good spring so far. Obviously, I tell myself at the beginning of every season, you know, things are going to happen. You know, that's the nature of this marathon is unexpected things are going to happen, both good and bad. You know, guys are going to outperform expectations. Guys are going to underperform. You know, this is the marathon. But I feel really good about the depth we have on this team. I think we're a much deeper and more talented team than we were a year ago. And so I'm excited to get started. But like I said, I always try to remind myself that
things happen.
Yeah. Things are going to happen that are unexpected, and it's our job to react to those appropriately. But I'm excited. Like I said, I think we're deeper and more talented, and we got a really good test early. You know, you look at our schedule early, not just these two games in Tokyo, but in general, we have a really hard early season schedule. We're going to be tested early, and I hope we respond well.
The Score Midday Show, 10 to 2 on 670 The Score.
As we broadcast live through the Hyundai Studios, brought to you by your local Hyundai dealers, we are through them because we are at Wings and Rings today to celebrate opening day on the South Side. We have a crowd. They're already cheering. We keep that energy up for the 3:10 first pitch. Guys, what you do in between now and then is up to you. Come by and enjoy an ice-cold Yingling before the game, brought to you by Yingling. Yingling, America's oldest brewery. Marshall Harris, we just heard Jed Hoyer. That was during the Tokyo series. We talked a lot, filling in for the afternoon show yesterday for Spiegel and Holmes, about part one of the Q&A that came out from John Greenberg of The Athletic with Jed Hoyer. He used the phrase, we are going to have to outperform expectations to make the playoffs. He did qualify it by saying the teams that don't have to are probably teams like the Dodgers. We know the Dodgers are in a class of their own. But part two came out today, and he does qualify the comments a little bit more. The pulled quote in the headline says, expecting young players to take a step forward. I don't think anyone is in disagreement when it comes to that aspect of this.
No, I definitely think when you look at where we are and how we got here and understanding why the Pecota projections and everybody else expects certain things to happen for the Cubs this year. You can start with Pete Crow Armstrong. It begins with him, even if the lineup does not. I think he talks about it in a way where he helps to further give context to what he was saying, because I know our initial reaction to hear him for the second straight season talk about guys needing to outperform the expectation for them, that's not good. You should put together a team that performs at the level you expect, and that's how you get to the playoffs. That should be the formula. So for him to hammer home they need to outperform what we expect of them is kind of crazy, except for now he's talking about young players who obviously don't have as big and long resumes on the back of their baseball cards as some of these veterans. I'll give you the quote, because John Greenberg asked him, he said, you have a lower payroll than last year. You're relying on a rookie at third base right now. You've got a second-year guy, MPCA, in center. You trust his defense, but his offense, you're not sure about. You have Michael Bush at first. He says there's a little bit of volatility there with these young players at important positions. And his answer is interesting, because he says, I probably look at it as upside, not volatility. I think when you talk about beating projections or overperformance, it usually comes with young players. Guys entering those second and third years where they have a chance to take a big step forward. If we're going to get to a sort of 75th percentile or above outcome on this season, I think you're going to look back at some of the significant grouping of these young players you just mentioned, Pete, Michael Bush, Matt Shaw, Ben Brown. I think you're going to see some of these young players take a step forward. And you know what? Jed Hoyer is absolutely right. They will have to take a step forward if they want to go to the playoffs. They can't have Matt Shaw come in and be a guy who bats 200 and has an OPS under 700 and plays not up to snuff defense. He doesn't have to be a gold glove third baseman, but he's got to make the routine plays.
The problem, too, is the Cubs are so hungry and so in need of power that you want everybody to hit a home run. You want everybody to hit more than they did. Three hits against Yamamoto in Japan, I get it. You know, I get that that's going to happen, right? Three hits total as a team in that game. They end up with eight in game two. As Craig Counsell famously said, they had six singles and the Dodgers had six home runs. That's a good example of the contrast you're seeing. When we talk about the need for the offense, it's not just getting on base. It's not just walking. We know they can do that. It's the extra base hits. It's needing that extra power. We love what we've seen out of Dansby Swanson, especially for the past few weeks. And Greenberg asked him about that as well. What about Dansby Swanson? He had that surgery after last season. I don't know if that was a surprise to you, but he didn't hit like you had expected him to last season, and that probably had a big effect on your year. Hoyer says he was banged up early for sure. He got better. I think his second half was better than his first half, certainly. But yeah, he was definitely feeling it last year, and you know that affected his offense. To his credit, He still played great defense and was a valuable player for us. But the first half wasn't up to his standards, and we were a little bit surprised at the end of the year when he decided to have surgery. We were a little bit surprised. That's about as much as you're ever going to hear a GM say. He also said, but that also told us a lot about him, the fact that he kind of grinded through it. I think that's something that we knew about Dansby, was that he takes his responsibility seriously. He wants to be out there. But in the case of what we saw last season, was it to a fault? You know, now that even we're seeing more out of him this year with the bat, was it to a fault? Did he think that his defense could at least do something more for the team if he's out there? I could see why a player wants to put that pressure on himself.
Listen, here's what we know about Dansby Swanson. He likes to play 162. How do I know this? He's done it in a major league career at a time when guys aren't really playing 162 anymore. Now, he's a little bit older now. You hit those 30s, your body doesn't react the same to doing everyday athletic activity as most people in real life can tell you, whether you're a professional athlete or not. For him, I think why they were surprised is because they figured if he needed surgery, he would just get the surgery to get back completely healthy. The fact that he was able to gut it out tells us that they didn't know how bad it really was until he asked, hey, I got to get the surgery.
Yeah.
And now he looks like a different ball player this year than he did last year. And I think that's a good thing for everybody involved, because if he can have the type of season they paid him to have with that big contract, I think everything's going to be all right. And he's one example of several veterans. I don't need guys who hit 40 home runs, because I look at the track record. They don't have guys who hit 40 home runs. But if everybody can hit 20, and then the guys that you need to can hit 25 to 30, you're going to be okay. Looking up and down that lineup, everybody should be able to put up 20 home runs. Except
yeah,
for maybe Nico Hornet.
At least. And you expect Kyle Tucker to put up 30.
Yeah. And so
I do.
If that's the case, if guys come up short and they're only hitting 15, 18 home runs and they're not getting to 35-plus doubles, then you have a problem. But it does come down to what you said before, the slug of it all. You can get guys on base. You can walk. We saw that in the Tokyo series. But if you don't have guys who can pop it out or at least hit a three-run double, you're going to be in trouble in a lot of these games you face, not necessarily against the bad teams, but against the upper tier or even – in their case, the Milwaukee Brewers within your own division.
It's just painful to think about how many times I've talked about runners in scoring position.
Well, that's a thing.
Painful. We wanted to let you know as well, this is big, Jed Hoyer will be on with Spiegel and Holmes at 5:15 today. 5:15 with Spiegel and Holmes. They are live from Circa in Las Vegas. So I don't think they got Jed out there. I think Jed's probably in Arizona or Chicago, one of the two. But Jed is on at 5:15, so you won't want to miss that. That's later today. As we continue our coverage of opening day here on the South Side as well.
Does it feel like opening day? It does not feel like opening day to me.
Well,
and maybe that's because we already dealt with the Cubs over in Tokyo and waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning to watch them.
Yeah, and even yesterday we got texts on the text line saying, oh, it's Cubs opening day tomorrow. It's not, actually. It's domestic opening day. It's one of their four in a series. Sacramento opening day is what I'm curious about when you talk about getting weird. There's another quote that I want to bring up from this as well. Greenberg asked him, this is your fifth year running the Cubs since Theo Epstein left. You had to build up the farm system and trade away most of the remaining guys from 2016. How do you think you and Carter Hawkins and everyone else has done putting the team in a better position? He says everyone has a set of challenges they're facing. I think the challenge for me taking over was that Theo left a year early. There was a lot of questions about, remember what they were going to do with that money that Theo had walked away from? Like, were they going to reinvest that in the team? And it says, and in part because he knew that we needed a reset, and he was sort of giving me a chance to do that. So that was the first two full years, trying to build up the farm system and sort of get the organization back to health. I think that we've done that with really good young players. Our books are super clean going forward. And the organization is very healthy and in a great position that way. I thought that was very interesting.
Which part was the most interesting? There's a couple of things I picked up from that. The books being super clean going forward, only because we know about the impending work stoppage and trying to figure out, if Kyle Tucker's only here for a year, what's your plan next year? You've already got to be looking ahead. Because it ain't Cam Smith. He doesn't play here anymore.
Oh, man, aren't we watching to see what happens in Houston today?
Of course we are.
He also mentioned that there's two seasons left in the CBA. And as you get close to the end of the CBA, people do start to think about things a little differently in terms of contracts. And he said, I think that is certainly the case now. I know that that's happening. I think any GM who doesn't acknowledge it is not telling you the whole truth, which I understand.
Or they're really bad at their jobs because you need to be aware.
Well, or maybe they're just not allowed to talk about it as freely. Jed, in his last year of his deal, maybe he's a little bit more able to. But when you look at the numbers themselves, when you see the committed years of money based on the data, that indicates to you alone that teams are acting in kind.
Okay, so my curiosity is about not just baseball as a whole, but when you look at the Cubs and the White Sox, don't have to worry about the White Sox. They weren't spending any money anyway. But when you look at the Cubs, if there are just 2 years left before it all shuts down and potentially we lose an entire season, because that's really on the table, the idea that in 2027 there won't be a baseball season, which is crazy, but also very much a real possibility as the owners have to figure out what they want to do. And then after figuring out what they want to do, you can call it super big market versus small market. We know the Cubs are not the super big market. They're just the big market because they don't spend like a super big market. And then after they figure out amongst themselves what they want to do, then they've got to go to the players and try to get a deal done. And I think the salary cap thing is going to be the main holdup slash injection that's going to be rejected by the bodies of MLB players. So that all takes precedent in the macro over the micro of this season and then next season. Because if Kyle Tucker's not here next year, and I don't think any of us expect him to be here, then I don't know, man. I don't know what the plan is next year. I'm excited and curious to find out, though.
Yeah, you know, you bring up a good point. Here we are, hopeful about the Sox future, and we know kind of what we're expecting to see next season based on certain prospects coming up at certain times. I cannot tell you that for the Cubs. I cannot tell you what they're going to do when it comes to either the possibility of extending Kyle Tucker or how you replace that offense. We know what happened when it came to Cody Bellinger, the other, you know, big source of offense for them. No matter how you look at it, relatively speaking, that was the case. So when you consider those two things right there, just not having Bellinger on the team, he goes to the Yankees, you've got Kyle Tucker for 1 year. I can't tell you what the exact plan is, which is wild when you think about it like that.
Guess we'll have to wait and see and talk about it every single day until something is resolved.
Until something is resolved.
Here are your all-star pitchers from the Atlanta Braves, Greg Maddux.
Maddux, fastball, curveball, a real strong slider and a change, and he works them inside, outside.
Greg Maddux on the hill for the Cubs. 1-2-3. We're accustomed to that from Greg Maddux.
Strike three in the outside corner. That's where Greg Maddux makes a living.
He looks like a guy that wants to sell you insurance, but he means business.
We got Cy Young winners over here.
There's a drive into left field. It's well hit. It's gone.
Schick stick the long ball.
Hey, it's hard to get him to smile on the field.
1-2 to Boggs. You don't see Wade Boggs take that kind of a swing.
Greg Maddux has won his 14th game of the year. He did it with 78 pitches. And, folks, you just saw a great pitching performance.
Greg Maddux, the best pitcher of this decade. Can his work for the Atlanta Braves lead to a first world title for the South?
Hello.
Ooh. I mean, that's part of pitching. You come up and in on guys. Remember, in the American League, that stuff doesn't happen. In the National League, it's more part of an everyday day at the office.
This is a guy that when he pitched for the Cubs, he said, what is the knockdown sign?
Oral Hershiser suffers his first ever postseason loss, and all it took was Greg Maddux.
The team of the 90s has its world championship. And there it is. LaCroix Hawkins puts the finishing touch to get Greg Maddux his 300th career win.
People ask me why my Hall of Fame plaque has no logo. I spent 12 years in Chicago, 11 in Atlanta, and both places are very special to me.
Congratulations to Greg Maddux. Bud Biscay looking for number 3,000.
Without experiences in both cities, I would not be standing here today.
Fans love him here in Chicago.
How
How about it? Greg Maddux has been out here with us at Circa Stadium Swim. Well, not with us. He lives out here. But the fact that we get to share and think and talk about Greg Maddux, the pitcher, knowing that he's not far, that he's been here in this building with us, is pretty awesome.
Pretty awesome. And our producer's shining in this segment. In a minute or two, you'll hear from Shane Reardon, who talked to Greg Maddux earlier in the day. And that open right there from Chris Tannehill was freaking awesome. Just like the fact that he threw a complete game in 78 pitches. I mean, there's a stat named after
him. A Maddux.
A complete game with less than 100 pitches, folks, is called a Maddux. Or is it a complete game shutout specifically? I forget whether it's essentially a shutout specifically or just a complete game under 100 pitches. Either way.
Well, as we know, Maddux would set up a guy and give up a home run on purpose to set him up later for the postseason.
For the postseason.
So I would consider it not, doesn't even have to be a shutout.
Let me tell you, every time I think of Maddux, I think of Warren Spahn, the great pitcher of the Boston Braves and Atlanta Braves, Milwaukee Braves. I don't know if he ever got to Atlanta, actually, but Warren Spahn used to talk about pitching as in a professorial way. He used to say that hitting is timing, and pitching is upsetting timing. And that was Maddux's genius. I talked about that exact thing with him once, and he knew the quote. And, like, he would set you up with a high pitch inside and then the slow pitch outside, and knowing that it was fooling you way more than just the pitch type or the location. It was the combination of things. He messed with everybody's timing, maybe better than anyone who has ever pitched in Major League Baseball.
A Maddux is a complete game shutout.
Thank you.
Fewer than 100 pitches.
Thank you. Thank you. So, yeah, I mean, that's him. Just like, just simply put, maybe the greatest to do it ever when you think of the era that he dominated, him and Pedro Martinez. And Maddux did it longer. Maddux did it longer. So Greg might get that vote.
It's pretty incredible because he has 13 of them.
Maddux is?
Yeah, and no one else has more than 7.
Wow.
Kyle, that's amazing. Kyle Hendricks has Kyle Hendricks has 2 or maybe just 1, but nobody else has more than 7. That's amazing. In the history, they started counting pitches at a certain point.
You heard that clip in the Hall of Fame speech there? I was there. That was one of the great days.
Maddux and Big Frank.
Maddux, Big Frank,
yep.
Glavin, Tony La Russa, Joe Torre. No, not Smoltz yet.
But Maddux and Glavin together.
Yeah, but what a giant class there. I don't know if you'll ever see anything like that again with, like, you know, just that number of great people from, like, all types of tiers.
That's amazing. And if I remember correctly, Tony...
Oh, okay.
Tony drove to the... he drove there.
Stop it.
And he hit the dais. He drove right into the dais.
I tried to have some reverence for the man's career. You know?
Danny, you tried, dude.
I know.
You can't try anything
from me, too.
You can't.
That's fine. It's, you know,
come on,
don't set him up for anything.
What, would you guys like to go through the ridiculous monster numbers of Greg Maddux?
Sure.
All right. His war. What would you guess Greg Maddux's war is?
75.
120.
106.6.
That's amazing.
Wow. That's a lot of wins.
That's a lot of wins above replacement.
355 wins.
I mean, that's outrageous considering the era.
That's when the game was the game.
Yeah,
you know,
man.
I mean?
Yeah.
An ERA for a career of 3.16.
Yeah.
And we're talking about, what, 23 years of pitching
in
Major League Baseball? He threw 5,008 1/3 innings.
It's outrageous.
God.
Look at the consecutive years of an ERA under 3. How many consecutive seasons with an ERA under 3?
From 1992 on, he had a 218, a 236, a 156, a 163, 272, 220, 222, and then it jumped back up to the threes in 99.
God, he sucked in 99.
Yeah, he did.
He only had a 357 ERA in 99.
I mean, just an outrageous run in the middle of through the steroid era.
I took a job as an usher at Wrigley Field in 1999. I was in high school, partly because I knew I'd get to see someone like Greg Maddux.
Oh wow!
Well, and you're such a big Cub fan.
Oh, obviously.
Yeah.
How could you not be?
Me and Tanny both.
8-time All-Star, 18-time Gold Glove, 4 Cy Youngs, 4 ERA titles, World Series, the whole thing. I also loved when he would hit.
He's got at least 5 bombs, right? Because I was going through some of his stuff today. where he went yard against the Red Sox. Him and Michael Barrett, I believe, in the same game.
Yeah.
Like, Barrett was supposed to be here earlier today.
Well, his close personal friend.
Five home runs, 84 yeah. RBIs for Greg Maddux in his career.
The Man. 18 gold gloves is insane.
It's real.
It is insane.
That might be more insane than the ERA numbers.
The problem is the gold glove spent a good 20 years there as purely a reputation award. Like, there was a lame period for gold gloves.
He got a gold glove in his last season.
Yeah, I mean,
at 42.
There's no way he deserved that.
God.
Jeez, man. Like,
Jesus That's Christ, right. dude. You didn't have to look at him face-to-face today, huh?
No, I didn't. But I would have said, I'll say it to Derek Jeter when I see him.
Well, like, he sucks.
It's like when Derek Jeter
sucks.
Jeter took Alexei Ramirez's gold glove.
No.
But, Shane, you got to be face-to-face with Greg Maddux today.
Yes. It was so cool because I have this vivid memory, me and my parents, when he was sitting on win 299 with the Cubs. We went to the game. We were in the 300 or the 400, like whichever section overhangs over the 100s or the 200s.
Yeah.
And he lost that game, and there was rain. And then he went and won 300, I think, in L.A. in his next start. And, like, watching my mom watch that game and then being able to send her the picture of, like, me and him in the interview today was just incredible.
That's really cool.
So your mom was a huge Maddux fan?
Massive. Massive.
Really?
Yeah, massive.
That's outstanding.
Yeah, massive.
Yeah.
Today was very cool, and we had a very quick conversation. There were a couple other different media outlets, so I didn't get a ton of time, and I tried to get him to come up here, obviously.
But did he address his close personal friend, Barry Rosner?
He did, right off the top. Right off the top. And when I said, hey, we want you to come up, he's like, no, my wife told me I got to go buy chicken and come home right after I throw the pitch. He said he's got to babysit grandkids today. I've got strict instructions to go and buy chicken and come home.
Oh, that's phenomenal. We would have got him some chicken.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, we have it right here.
We do have some chicken.
We do. We have
right
a
here.
Lot. And look, it's possible that Barry Rosner may have played a role in Greg Maddux's Hall of Fame speech. It's possible. I don't know that for sure.
Yeah, he might have written the whole thing.
But it's possible that Barry Rosner worked really hard with Greg Maddux on his Hall of Fame speech.
It's possible. It's possible. And, there's a few other Hall of Fame speeches that also feel sort of Rosnerian.
Possibly.
In that, allegedly.
The photo of Barry and Greg Maddux in the Braves dugout, circa like 1995.
Amazing!
It's so Rosnery.
It's I would frame it and put it in my home.
Sure,
if my
sitting
wife
on the bench back there, right?
I believe that was during the era when Barry was in fog hat. Or it sure looks like it anyway.
That was a lot of smoke on the water.
Yeah. Oh, look at you.
Slow ride, is that fog hat?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it is.
So
he
got close. He got close.
Wait,
smoke on the water.
It's smoke.
Deep purple.
Oh, damn it.
Yeah.
God, a lot of misses for me lately.
Yeah, it's okay, but it's about the
But you got a hit on this one. So, all right, set it up for us, Shane. What are we getting ready to hear here?
So Greg Maddux is here at Circa throwing out the first pitch. Was supposed to be to Michael Barrett. Michael Barrett was not here today, so he threw it to his son, Chase. And we just talked about Barry. We talked about the state of baseball. We talked a little bit about Justin Steele. So, Tyler, go ahead. Hit Greg Maddux and myself at the Circa Sportsbook this morning.
Greg Maddux here at Circa Sports throwing out the first pitch at the Circa Sportsbook. Greg, first tell me everything you hate about Barry Rosner.
He's short.
Very.
Lies a lot. Makes a lot. Half his stuff is made up.
A lot. Yeah, a lot.
Never gives me a good golf pick. Other than that, he's a pretty good guy.
Yeah, other than that, that's not a lot of good stuff. What's your favorite part about being here at Circa? This place is awesome.
Yeah, it's cool. It's a fun place, you know. It's kind of a guy's hangout. All the sports going on, and, you know, you got the pool, nice views from the rooms here, and it's just a fun place, you know. It's one of the better sports books in Vegas, if not the best.
Do you like being out here in Vegas? It gets hot as hell.
Well, I mean, you know, we kind of cheat and hit the beach in the summers, but you know, we spend a good 9 months a year out here at least, and you know, it's a great city. You know, it's a great city. It's got good golf, you know, parks, churches, schools, recreation, all that stuff, and the strip. So
It's a great place to live.
What do you miss most about Chicago right now? Anything?
Probably Wrigley Field. Yeah. Going to the ballpark every day. You know, it was a special place to go, and every time you wore that Cubs uniform, walked on the field, it was a pretty special feeling.
Do you look back fonder with your memories with the Cubs or the Braves, you think? Or is it kind of equal?
Obviously, the Braves we won more.
Yeah, so, yeah, you did.
The one World Series was with the Braves.
Yeah.
But, you know, I came up a Cub, and I almost left as a Cub. And, mm-hmm. But I had a little bonus two-year vacation on the West Coast. And but, you know, it's all special. You know, I look back at the baseball career and, you know, obviously Chicago, Atlanta, big part of it. And then, you know, L.A. and San Diego as well. So, you know, Vegas to me has always been home. And the roots have always been here. But I've really enjoyed playing at Wrigley Field. Wrigley Field and, like, maybe San Diego were probably the two coolest places for me to play.
I know you moved quickly as a pitcher, but how do you think you would have handled the pitch clock if you were playing today? All these the new rules, I don't like them.
I love it. It's a hitter's clock. Don't forget. I don't know why they call it the pitcher's clock. It's a hitter's clock. I don't know how many times I sat there and watched Kenny Lofton dance on the on-deck circle until his walk-up song was over. So, you know, it gets those guys in the box, and I think they're only allowed one time out.
Yeah.
You know, so, 3-2 was an automatic timeout for about five or six guys in the league, and I think it would have been great. I think we would have had a lot of games under 2 hours.
One of my favorite, like a Mark Burley game, one of my favorite things that you've ever said, I think Rosner probably wrote it for you, was when you said that when you were a kid, you guys played every sport, and that's what made you last so long, and guys are too hyper-focused on baseball now as kids. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think so. You know, I think, well, obviously, you know, the more pitches you throw, the better chance you have of being hurt. And, you know, when we were growing up, you know, we started 12, 13 games a year. You know, these guys are, they have their 12 or 13 games a year in high school, and then, you know, they're throwing another 20 or 30, you know, over summer ball and club ball and all that. So, you know, it's hard to hurt your elbow if you're playing basketball. So, you know, we played a lot of basketball growing up, and we didn't throw as much as the kids do today.
Justin Steele pitching for the Cubs tonight against the Diamondbacks. What do you like about Justin Steele?
Well, you know, I'd have to watch him pitch a little more to really give you an honest answer, but I'm sure if he's starting an opening day for the Cubs, he's pretty legit.
Man, that's a great job, Shane.
That is great.
Put that on your reel.
Yeah, that's really good.
Like,
man.
For real.
Like, I hate it. Like, I went to a talkabout, and I make fun of people who say talkabout.
It happens.
I went to a talkabout.
It happens, dude. You ended up with 5 minutes impromptu. We hadn't even talked about it and prepped it as a team.
Yeah.
And you got Greg Maddux stuff. I'm going to hold on to the hitter's clock. Like, that is the correct framing of what the pitch clock is about.
Yeah.
It's about keeping these guys from taking unnecessary timeouts and keeping them from stretching it out, because most pitchers do want to work quickly. There are some that don't, and we've focused on them because it's the pitch clock, and that's the way to signify what it is. But the framing is correct from Maddux's perspective.
Can,
I like that.
Can I just tell you from a former catcher's perspective?
Please.
We also want to work quick.
Yeah,
you don't want to be back there all day.
Right, so that means you want your pitchers to work quick.
100%. There is a rhythm that your pitcher can get into that it becomes difficult for everyone. And great pitchers know this. I bet if you took a look, I'd have to do a statistical study on it, and this is just me using anecdotal evidence. But I bet if you looked at Greg Maddux's games, if you looked at Mark Burley's games, the amount of errors per game are down in those games because defenders are on their toes.
Defenders love it. They love it when a pitcher works quick.
It just sucks when you've got a guy that's playing. And I get it from the hitter's perspective, too.
Sure.
I get it from the idea of, oh, I'm going to throw your timing off. You want to throw my timing off? I'm going to throw yours off. I'm going to do some weird stuff. I'm going to. But unfortunately, for some guys, like, then it turns into to twitches and clicks and stuff.
Yep,
and like, I don't know if I can hit anymore without going through this whole thing that I ordinarily do before a pitch is thrown.
Yeah, man. No, absolutely. And when you're thinking about it like Maddux thinks about pitching, you're preying on whatever mindset you've just put the hitter in. So, like, you're getting him thinking with one pitch and then trying to take advantage of that with the next pitch. So you don't want him to reset and breathe deep and you know, try to reset. Can I tell you about Greg Maddux, basketball player, for a second?
Sure.
High school basketball, really, really good player. But there's a story, there's a famous story about a weekend in Cooperstown in 1988 when the Cubs were playing in the Hall of Fame game that used to happen every summer, and it was the Cubs and the Cleveland Indians at the time playing, and Bud Black and Greg Swindell of Cleveland played a two-on-two basketball game against Rick Sutcliffe and Greg Maddux of the Cubs that apparently was a very high-level two-on-two basketball game, a game in which 770 big league wins.
Wow.
We're on the basketball court at that time. So we got to ask Sutcliffe about that next time we talk to Sut, because Sut was pretty good, but I think Maddux was the best of those four basketball players.
We don't have time to really dig into it now, and we should bring it up at a later date, because there are so many people inside of the Score audience that are sports parents. Every single time that we talk to an athlete or coach, every single time when we're talking about baseball players, what do they tell us? They tell us you need to be a multi-sport athlete. They tell us you need to take a break from the games that you're playing. They tell us that the fact that they were cross-training by playing running track or playing basketball or swimming, it made it so that their lives were easier and they were less injured as they made their way up
the
ranks.
There it is, like that last thing, because Maddux said it right there. There's only a certain number of pitches in that arm.
Correct.
Man. So limit the number of pitches by playing other stuff. And if you're a good athlete, it makes you better anyway. Carlos Rodon had a play today where Rodon had to go over and cover first.
He missed the base completely.
He missed the base completely and went, like, barreling into foul territory.
Ass over tea kettle.
Right, but if he wasn't a good athlete who played other sports in his life,
he'd be hurt.
He might have gotten hurt. We've seen, like, unathletic pitchers get hurt in that way. Like, so it's you're better off, like, keeping your muscles and your body attuned to athleticism in general.
And I know that a lot of these kids are that there is a cottage industry that is pushing a lot of these kids to play year-round.
Yep, yep, yep.
Yeah, you should be in this league, and you should be in a travel league, and all this stuff. When the answer to the issue, like, your kid's not going to get scouted just because they're doing all this stuff. Why not have them be the best athlete and have them not lose the joy?
Yeah.
Have it not become a job for kids when they're 10, 11 years old. They're traveling around. They're wasting a lot of your money.
Yeah.
And they're not even necessarily happy doing it.
You know what should help? And I don't know if it's going to help, but what should help is this reality that you can add velocity on the big league level now. Like, they have figured out ways for you to add velocity on the big league level where you don't have to freak out. If they can see it, it's like how they see the potential for power in the body of a hitter. They can now see the potential for more velocity in the body of a pitcher. So, like, this obsession with trying to get it early, I would love for that to be less mandatory. And that was a great overnight host, I think. Less mandatory, did a really nice job.
Yeah,
knew a lot about the three tech.
What's that?
He knew a lot about the three tech.
He knew a lot about the three tech. And he knew he had to do exactly what he was supposed to do.
Yeah, he was always around. They made him do it.
Shane, I know that you're going to shake your head and you're going to say no and all this stuff. That was a great interview.
Oh,
you did a great job with Greg Maddux.
Thank you.
And you should be proud of that. Like,
that's
not an easy environment to do an interview with a legendary player, and you did a phenomenal job.
Yeah,
he was very nice.
The only thing you should have also done is gone and get him some chicken so he could take it.
Well, I mean, he told me he had to go to the grocery store and get it for
you should have taken care of that. You should have taken care of that.
I was going to. Yeah,
that is one of my favorite things with male athletes.
Yeah.
When you see them be like, oh, yeah, like, so my wife kind of runs stuff.
For sure.
I'm just here.
Yeah.
I got to go do some stuff,
yeah,
man. Or else she's going to be real mad.
I'm here having a moment. I'm making some money from Circa. I'm throwing out a pitch. I'm being Greg Maddux superstar. But if I don't come home with that chicken,
it's going to be a problem for me. It's good stuff.
It's too much praise for Shane. You know, if you were producing back in the 80s, you would have went back to the kitchen. Hey, give me a raw chicken and a bag of ice.
That's right.
I'll save Greg Maddux 20 minutes.
That's where the game was the game.
Yeah. If I was producing in the 80s, I could just call a hotel and say, hey, I want to talk to Greg Maddux.
That's true.
It was so much easier back then.
And if you were producing in the 80s, there would have been a ton of cocaine.
Yeah. Exactly.
That would have also been a thing.
I hear you subtweeting Jesse Rogers.
Not Jesse. My guy, Randy Merkin. I love Randy Merkin, but all he had to do was call a hotel.
Look, I will tell you, and Spies, you can probably attest to this because we're two old guys from the score at this point. We used to have to kind of know what guys' pseudonyms were.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes. Fake names, yeah.
And you'd ask him, hey, can I know what you registered, who you're registered as?
Yeah.
Dr. Gavorkian, please.
Steve Kerr was Ned Ryerson. He was Ned Ryerson.
It's a beautiful thing. Yeah. When we come back, a special Vegas Categories is next. Spiegel and Holmes on the score.
It's a fun show, fun day, and today we get another day closer to opening day.
Yes.
Cubs and White Sox open tomorrow, there's a lot going on with the roster configuration, and I still am wondering about the White Sox, what their order's going to look like, what their lineup's going to look like, and the Cubs still have some questions to answer.
They do, but they're more back end of the roster stuff.
Yeah.
I think we know what they're
right.
You know, we kind of have a good feel for who the Cubs have on their team. And it's a big year for the Cubs. Really big year. I don't know that it's that big a year for the White Sox. It seems like a year where, like, I'll put it to you this way. If Cam Smith was trying out for the White Sox, he would be their star player. They might even trade him. If Cam Smith was trying out for the Cubs, I'm not sure he makes the team.
So this is going to be a sore spot all season long. Just going to warn you right now.
Cam Smith?
Yeah, because
don't mention Cam Smith.
I think Cam Smith is one of the best stories in spring training across major leagues.
I agree with you.
Because of the way it went down yesterday. The Astros informed him he made the team. They got his parents involved. He's 22 years old.
They brought his folks in to tell
him. Oh, my gosh. It was weepy.
It was unbelievable.
It was emotional. And it stung a little bit if you're a Cub fan. Because I think that when you look at what the Astros have done, accelerated his progress and obliterated the process and said, you know what? You're good enough now.
Yeah, there's no process.
They're not worried about skipping steps.
Yes.
If he were in Chicago, he would not be on the major league team. I really believe that.
Yeah.
I think the Cubs would not have done that.
I honestly don't believe he could possibly have made the major league team. And Dustin was like, well, they could use another outfielder. They've got three starting outfielders.
Let me submit this, Dustin.
So the kid wouldn't play.
He wouldn't.
Would they leave him on the bench?
Come on. They say a Suzuki was not a starting outfielder. So they technically only had two.
But the thing of it is.
King Tuck. No, but that's how they got Cam Smith.
King Tuck wouldn't be here.
Right.
That's what I'm saying.
But
so
Dustin,
he would not be here. That's my point.
Objectively.
So you don't want him here.
Dispassionately.
This is what we're talking about. It's going to sit there all year. It's going to linger all year long.
It's going to linger. It's going to be a point of comparison. But, Dustin, realistically, all those things, do you think the Cubs would have changed his position to make him an outfielder?
I think Kevin
Alcantara. That was a stroke of brilliance.
If they didn't make that move, Alcantara would be the guy they would use. He wouldn't be in the minor leagues. He'd be playing left field, most likely.
Well, the thing
is. Or Owen Casey, potentially. Or maybe they would have kept Bellinger.
How has Cam Smith beating those guys to the major leagues? How has Cam Smith beaten Owen Casey, Kelvin Encounter, Kate Horton to the major leagues?
Because he's not blocked.
Because he hit six home runs.
He's blocked.
That's why.
He's blocked as a third baseman. He is not blocked as an outfielder.
Well, that's very creative, and it's very smart that the Astros changed his position. And it's going to be something to keep an eye on. You're not going to draw any hard and fast conclusions, but the fact that he's making history, and there are only two other major leaguers in history that have ever gotten to the big leagues faster than this.
It's crazy.
It is crazy.
It's crazy.
Is it going to be something that they regret?
Why can't the White Sox draft a guy like that 14th? That guy, I mean, honestly, you see him, and again, he doesn't just look good swinging. he makes a noise that lets you know, wow.
It's the thwack of the bat.
Yeah, he really can
it hit. Is.
And I just wonder, how do you fall to 14? What about all the teams that drafted people ahead of him? I want to go look at that draft.
Well, I don't know that we've had the sense when they drafted him 14 that he was capable of being a guy that would skip the minors. I don't think that we had that conversation last year. Whether I can remember vaguely on Inside the Clubhouse on Saturday during our show during the week, when we talked about the Cubs' first-round draft pick, it was like, all right, they got another good guy, kind of the comp with why right. did they draft right. another infielder, but he projects with Matt Shaw at second and Cam Smith at third. Nobody talked about him being in the outfield.
That's true.
And but, the Astros, I mean, they're creative there. They've got Jose Altuve in left field. They've got Cam Smith in right field.
Uh-oh. What happened?
We dropped your mic there.
I was telling you in the talk back. Outfield defense might prove to be a problem.
It could be a problem. But he's 22 and he's athletic.
If they're scoring 6 or 8 runs a game because of the bats, you can kind of hide
it. Yeah. So that's just fascinating to me because I've often wondered about when you draft guys in baseball, why it takes them so much longer than
yes.
other sports to
yes.
get to the majors.
Yes.
And the Astros have maybe had the same question. Why wait? Why not? Are they harming his development by maybe
we'll find
skipping
out.
Steps?
I mean, you know, that is a great question that will be answered in front of our eyes over the course of the season.
I just, if Kyle Tucker hits 35 homers, it's a moot point to some degree.
Yes.
But you know what? It won't go away.
Well, when he leaves, because they can't somehow take any of the money that they make on game day. Did you see that story?
Oh, my gosh.
And transfer it to...
Cubs make $3.25 million a day.
Yeah. A game.
A game. Well, so a day game.
They left $650 in Japan.
But the Major League Baseball makes them whole.
I know.
Major League Baseball will cover all of that. And I think, though, that's a big number. It did not... Remember that number? Did not really know that number, but that's a big number.
That money should go directly to Bergman. It's an apology. We didn't offer you more.
Well, I think Kyle Tucker leaving the Cubs at the end of this year, if that's an inevitability, yeah. the Cam Smith development is going to be one that lingers
no question.
For a very long time.
No question.
And it becomes one of these... I don't want to. We don't know so much yet, but how many other guys in other sports are the ones that got away?
Yeah, that's the problem.
Are the ones that were skipped over?
That's the problem. He has done nothing yet.
The Mahomes effect.
He has done nothing yet, and he has skipped the minor leagues, and we'll see if that impacts him.
Is it like Jose Quintana all over again? Like that deal? Who did the Cubs give up for Jose Quintana?
It's more like Fernando Tatis.
I like Mully's comp because he was so young. And you know what happened with Tatis is a thorn in the Sox fans' side for years, but I don't know that at that point in time you anticipated him being
good. He grew 2 inches or something.
He grew into being a star player.
Yeah,
and
he was 17.
That's probably a better comp.
But I think, and it's a good comp. The only reason I'm going to go with my comp, because you always try to protect your side of the argument, is that the Cubs, when they went to the Quintana, they were going for it.
What about Dylan Cease? Is it more Dylan Cease? Because Quintana... You know what I'm saying? Like, he had a track record.
Right, but I'm saying the Cubs did that at that point because they wanted to try to do it again.
They gave up two guys in
Eloy and
Dylan Cease.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, Eloy obviously hasn't panned out for anybody.
You know, though, you're right. That's not a bad one either. But I think two things can be true, and I'm wondering what you guys think. Obviously, you were lamenting the possibilities because that could be something that you look at. And I don't know if regret is the right word. But it's going to be hard to watch him become an all-star in Houston. But Jed had to make that deal. He had to make that deal. You had to get Kyle Tucker. You had to take that risk. The urgency was there because you have to win this year. And I do think it's somewhat remarkable that the Astros think that Cam Smith can help them win this year.